Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the Friday edition of The Realignment. This is a great time to quickly note that these Friday extra episodes we produce throughout the week are now available because of Supercast subscribers. Supercast is the service that we actually use to monetize The Realignment and bring in subscriber support from listeners like you. We fund ourselves at a rate of $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership. Ever since we launched the subscription in April, we've been able to bring in enough money to not only expand the show, but also really dial up our ambitions. So once again, if you believe in the work of The Realignment, if you like how we've been leveling the show up and going all these different places, we'd love to get your support at realignment.supercast.com. Now, if you aren't just looking to support our mission, but get additional content, you also get access to bonus episodes in addition to these extra ones we put out on Fridays. And you also get the chance to listen to and interact with our Q&A portion. So lots of really great things there for people who want to support the show. Once again, that's realignment.supercast.com. Now on to today's episode. Because it's Friday and I'm recording this a little late in the day, I'm going to just go a little longer than normal in this introduction. So I just want to give a quick preview so that folks who don't want to listen to me go on for a little longer can get the chance to just skip to the broad conversation. Today I'm speaking with Peter Leiden. He is the host of the Civilization Salons at the Long Now Foundation and is a senior advisor for strategic foresight at Autodesk. People who have heard the name Peter Leiden before will know that that probably happened yesterday when Sagar and I spoke with Balaji Srinivasan about Balaji's new book, The Network State. Around halfway through the episode, Balaji started talking about Peter Leiden's 2017 essay, which Jack Dorsey tweeted out, about how Peter believes that California is really a good way and useful way for thinking about how the future of the American political system will go about. Peter is very much interested in realignments, aka the theme of the show, and he thinks that folks should consider the idea that California, in his telling, is around 15 years ahead of the country, and really has been ever since the 1960s. California is where you had, obviously, Ronald Reagan come in the 1960s. 15 years later, he eventually becomes president of the United States after serving as governor. And 15 years after that, the tax revolts that really took over California in the late 1970s really presaged the Newt Gingrich revolution in 1994 when Republicans took back the House for the first time in 40 years. So there's been these a couple different instances of California presaging what happened. He argues the next thing that California is going to presage is eventual Democratic / progressive dominance of the country as the Republican Party is overwhelmed by demographic change, issues like climate denialism, and the inability to shift and meet the issues of the 21st century. His articulation is that the Republican Party in California failed along those exact lines, and that's why the state, which used to be competitive in the 20th century, has effectively been a one-party state since the early 2010s. And if you're going to look at California, he thinks there's a reason why leading Democrats such as Gavin Newsom and obviously Vice President Kamala Harris are coming from that part of the country. Now, Peter has been prescient in terms of his frameworks for way before the essay came out. He wrote a really interesting essay in Wired in the late 1990s called The Long Boom. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. But it basically was about looking at the word from 1997 to around 2020 and him giving an argument for why there is a scenario where a world of malaise and fear of decline, as he articulated people thinking about things in the 1990s, eventually could lead to a world of prosperity and greater technological accomplishment and security from a broader perspective. I was really interested in bringing that same mentality, that same approach to the current moment, 2020, which also brings us into his latest project, which is called The Transformation, which is also taking a similar broad approach to the next 20 to 30 years of American politics. This is a good place to note, and this is also why I wanted to go longer to explain my context here, that I don't really see an episode like this as a debate episode. Peter and I come from different perspectives. We come from different parts of the country. We obviously have way different careers. And I thought that it would be best for us to engage with his thought and think of where he was coming without quibbling too much on the spot. So it won't surprise you. I don't think that the Democratic Party is going to perform quite as well as he thinks it does. I don't think that a state that has one party ruling it is going to produce the sort of leaders who could be successful in the political environment in the 2020s. We'll get into that a bit, but TLDR, this was more about getting his perspective so that everyone here could come up with their own to think through these various issues. If you'd like to hear a little more or read a little more about how I'm thinking about these issues, you should definitely subscribe to today's Substack, which is actually going to come out later this afternoon. I will also link it in the show notes if you have not listened to it yet. Once again, this is easily the longest intro I've ever done, but I really wanted to contextualize Peter, and also because it's Friday, I'm going to be a little more indulgent with my thoughts here. I'm really, really, really curious what people think about this episode, so definitely subscribe to the Substack. Once again, that's realignment.substack.com. Email us at realignmentpod@gmail.com, or just send a general comment our way in the ratings and reviews section. Once again, the whole theme of this show is like, what is our specific scenario for how we think America is going to make it through this current moment? Everyone should come up with their own answer, whether or not you agree with Peter or not. For all that said, once again, incredibly long intro. Thank you for sticking with me here. Thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. Here is this episode. Peter Leiden, welcome to The Realignment.
Marshall, good to meet you.
Great to meet you too. I want to start by reading a quick quote from your 1997 piece, The Long Boom, that will set the stage well. Without an expansive vision of the future, people tend to get short-sighted and mean-spirited, looking out for themselves. A positive scenario can inspire us through what will inevitably be traumatic times ahead. Can you really give us the context for your thought around just that idea? Because I think this conversation is one that needs to be grounded in a degree of optimism.
Well, you're talking about I was one of the early folks at Wired Magazine. I kind of was with the founders as we built Wired Magazine in the 90s there. And that quote is a cover story I wrote with another guy called Peter Schwartz, who's kind of a world famous scenario planner at the time. And the two of us in the mid 90s were trying to write a positive scenario of what could happen as this nascent digital revolution rolled out. And also alongside essentially the beginnings of what I would call the first phase of globalization of this last era. And those two things were so nascent and so early. Again, the wall had just collapsed from the globalization side. You know, people were just trying to wrap their heads on what is the internet and the web and what's an Amazon and what are they trying to sell? What, I mean, it was just very early days. And yet, so those of us who really understood what was really going on here, the potential of these technologies and the potential of knitting together the global economy like that was just phenomenally powerful. And so we wrote essentially what a cover story that essentially told the history of the world from 1980, which is behind us, through the mid 90s when we were writing, to the year 2020. There's a 40-year history of the world in which we laid out in broad strokes what could very well could happen. Wasn't necessarily a total prediction, like it's inevitably going to happen, but it was like we have the potential to pull off what could be a very, very, very positive development for people all around the world. That was the premise of it. And then one of the, what you just wrote was essentially the paragraph. It was trying to get people, why is this important? And we kind of forget, but in the mid-90s, there was a big recession in the 90s. There was a kind of a crash in the economy. America was kind of like in the doldrums again, and everyone was worried about their kids and going to be worse off than them. And it was very, I mean, in some respects, there's echoes of today, although I think today is worse. But basically, there was a sense that people just were so doom and gloom and everything was down. And they really didn't think that these technologies... They literally didn't think these technologies were going to play out the way everyone, some of us were talking about. They didn't understand how these companies were ever going to become, you know, big or huge, let alone dominate the global economy. They didn't understand how even a digital economy was going to work compared to the good old economy of the 20th century. So anyhow, we laid this thing out and played it out. And I think it actually did pretty damn well. We did couch it, since it's a scenario and it's not like a total outright prediction. We did actually do a sidebar there, which is worth noting, which is we said there's 10 things that could happen, the 10 top things that we think could undermine or challenge the kind of rollout of these two, you know, uber phenomena, these two giant trends of digital revolution, globalization. And we laid out 10 of them. And incidentally, we can get that later. But all 10 of those have surfaced in some way by 2022. So anyhow, you'll go there if you want to. But in general, the idea is people have to see what's possible ahead of them. If you really want to motivate people, particularly in times of real turmoil or big change, they have to see a way forward. They have to see, like, well, how would that system work? How would I fit in that? How would my kid fit in that? How am I going to earn a living? Or how's my country going to fare? Or whoever it is. And at the time, people didn't have a way of thinking about this. And what we did in Wired was laid that out. And by the way, it became a lightning rod for a national conversation at the time. New York Times, The Economist, all kinds of people were kind of challenging it and coming at it and thinking we were nuts. It later went into a book, by the way. It went into multiple languages. It was in Chinese. It was in all kinds of different languages. It really did spark a kind of real discussion of the potential of the digital revolution, but also globalization and really what has now been the last 25 years for us.
Yeah, I want to pick at a couple of things there before getting into the specific 10 scenarios you described. So it's important to do a victory laps here. The first bit, though, could you reflect a bit on the 1990s? Because I'm very interested as a person who surveys the zeitgeist for a living, basically, as a podcaster. We now seem to be looking back at the 1990s as this like lost moment. So it's funny that you're talking about the 1990s at the time as being this moment of just gloom and this and this and that. I think a lot of folks, especially people like me who were born in 1992, look back at the 1990s as this, like, you know, things were pretty great. And like, we didn't take full advantage of them as a society, but this was really great. Like, the culture war had basically simmered down. There was all this opportunity, this, this, or that. Can you like reflect about the ways that we've reconceived of or thought of the 90s since you wrote the piece?
Well, think of the 90s as there's two halves of the 90s. The first half actually was that more downer period. It was literally a recession for those of us who were working. There was a lot of confusion with the fall of the Soviet Union. Like, it wasn't super triumphant. It's like, what the hell is going to happen now? These technologies were so nascent. I mean, literally people are like, well, who will ever put their credit card on the internet? That's insane. No one will ever do that. I mean, that was that level of questioning what was going on. So there wasn't like, oh, great. By the halfway mark, and then the second half, of course, the zeitgeist did shift, and we ended up going into a total boom. It was a tech boom. It was an economic boom. It was literally in the dot-com thing. It was just the sky's the limit of ideas, what you could do. And also from the American point of view, it was actually we were getting kind of our sea legs, and we were realizing, oh, my God, after the Cold War collapse, we are the only remaining superpower. And, oh, my God, all our companies are well-positioned to take advantage of this globalization. And, oh, my God, everyone's kind of booming, and everyone's looking at America, and trades flowed, and people make money, and wages were rising. So I would say when we think back now to the 90s, essentially, we have that kind of, oh my God, oh, what a great time it was. But I think we forget the beginnings of this. And so what you're reflecting on is like I'm talking about when we wrote this thing was the early 90s, predicting essentially what was going to come. But I think what you're reflecting on is the general decade. I think it is a sense that there was a big opportunity there. Now, looking way back, now that we're looking back 20 years from there, could we have done things differently? Should we have done things differently? Absolutely. There's a lot of things second guessing there. But that said, and I'm, again, not just an optimist in general, but I tend to see the more positive things through all of the kind of negativity that people talk about. America and the world accomplished great things in the 90s. And frankly, to be fair, we've actually accomplished great things in the last 20 years, too. And I think there's one of the things is we built a world historical moment of building a fundamentally new infrastructure that is reshaping, you know, not just the economy, society forever. That building of that incredibly amazing infrastructure went from nothing, basically. There was literally in the mid 90s, there's like 25 million Americans on. It was all Americans, basically, or, you know, that smattering of other people. And now we got, you know, 60% of the planet tracking this decade to basically have everyone online by the end of the decade with all the low-level satellites and all this stuff blanketing the world. That's an extraordinary thing, just to kind of go through that one technological piece. But I can name a ton of other ones that you could lay out that, you know, I think this idea that, you know, the last 25 years have been a kind of total mess and what a disaster, I think is not totally true. I think there is a strain there that we really got to don't lose track of actually from the big picture of world history and American history, even a lot of stuff was accomplished. That's quite remarkable and really is going to go down in world historical terms.
Okay. I love that framework. So I'd spend some time there then. a lot of your writing is, once again, looking at this 40, 50, even centuries long history, looking back. There's the, you know, obvious joke that like a curse would be live through interesting times. Mm-hmm. Looking at this post 1997 period, what do you think are examples of events that were incredibly serious? To not to diminish anyone's actual experience, but is the dot-com bubble going to be, the bursting of the dot-com bubble, is that going to be thought of? Is it thought of today in the same way? Obviously the 2008 financial crisis is going to be written about a century from now. The Iraq War is probably going to be written about a century from now because it really brings to that, the close, that post-Cold War moment. But how do you think about those specific events over that 20-year period?
The actual events or the events?
The actual, in terms of like when you're looking at history on 20, 30, 40, 50 century long scales, which of these events do you think are going to be truly defining versus they mattered, but they aren't going to be the tale of the century, maybe?
Well, let me just say, because my recent work is working from now for the next 30 years to 2050, and I've been looking at what to expect there. It's kind of like the sequel, you could say, to what I was doing the last 25 years. And I would say in the period of the last 25 years, which we've rung through, wringing our hands about all kinds of stuff, and a lot of political and social stuff, by the way, not really on the fundamentals of technology particularly, but we essentially have laid the groundwork for three world historical developments that literally people will look on for centuries to come, centuries. You know, it'll be like, we'll look back on the Enlightenment or we look back on the Roman Empire or whatever. It'll be that level of stuff. And one is we build a digital infrastructure and essentially have transitioned everything to digital. That is an incredibly powerful thing. And that really does fundamentally reorganize how you can pretty much do anything. We were saying this in the 90s. People had no idea what you're talking about. But you can look back now and you can see how that's happening. And of course, all the disruption in the industries and all that happened. But in general, to get all humans on a digital platform for running their economy and society is a crazy big thing. And we kind of are mostly through that. I would say that's been cracked. I mean, there's AI coming and a bunch of new things that are going to regenerate that. But basically, that's happened. The second thing is, in my opinion, this is me, is we essentially have to go to a kind of a sustainable economy and society ultimately, which we can talk about. And what happened in the last 25 years is we brought the cost down of renewable energies, solar energies, electric mobility, things. These things that essentially just pie in the sky in terms of the amount of money it would take to do those things, or they're not scalable. They're not, they're not adaptable. They won't. Those things grinded out over the last 25 years, got to the point where we now are at the point where these are tipping and we can actually start to scale on a monumental scale. That thing, getting the total, let's just say from the perspective of 100 years from now, let's say, oh my God, they went from carbon to clean energy in the 21st century. And then those 25 years we just went through were essential to get there. Because right now, if we didn't have the price points where they are and all the different adoption curves hitting where they are now, we couldn't have taken that on. And the third one I would say, looking back in the bank goods long version of human history, we're essentially going to have to be global. We're going to have to work at a planetary scale. I mean, you're not going to get 10 billion people to sustainably keep going for too long unless you have some ways of working in a global context. And so that first phase of globalization, of knitting the world together, some of it was technological through these digital technologies, but not just that. I mean, global travel just went through the roof. In the 80s, when I was a young guy, there was like 250 million people had visited another country, now by right before the pandemic, it was literally 1.5 billion a year. We're going all over the planet. I mean, there it's like all kinds of metric in terms of supply chains and knitting together, how everything's put together. I mean, we went through a phase of like, we're reorganizing humans on a global scale that works at a planetary scale, which is essentially absolutely necessary going forward if you're going to think centuries ahead, right? And so we did all three of these. We started these three crazy world historic projects in the space of these 25 years. Now, people don't think of it like that, but it'll become increasingly obvious in the next 30 years that those are the three giant challenges and that we are going to push that in ways to really scale it up. And so I kind of keep that perspective looking back as well as that perspective going forward. And I think that, if you really got to just grok your head on what's going on in the world here, and it explains American politics, it explains foreign policy right now with, the petro state of Russia kind of lunging all over the place. I mean, if you look at the bigger picture, what the world is going through right now is a transformation, the way I keep talking about it, it's a transformation of world historical scale that literally people will remember for centuries to come. If you think about that, it's like, holy shit. Okay, well, then that puts a different light on everything around here. And through that lens, you start to realize, huh, you know, things that you thought was, oh, just negative and bummer, would it start to be like, huh, you can see why that's happening, one, but also you can see the positive pieces of this. We're laying the ground for work, and we have laid the groundwork for something that is a truly amazing human accomplishment. And we got a lot more ahead of us, which we can talk about. But I'm saying, do not denigrate what happened in the last 25 years, honestly, as much as there's a lot of bad stuff that happened, and we can talk about that too.
Man, that's fascinating, because I love the 1-2-3 part here. So digital infrastructure, sustainable energy, and then three, the global context. I'm not going to quibble with one and two, because those are technologies, right? That is those are zeros and one. I mean, energy isn't quite like that, but the underlying idea is there. It can be invested in. There's research, there's development, progress builds on top of itself, all those bits, no quibbles. I do want to push on the global aspect of this, because it seems to me on a couple of different levels, I don't see how what you're describing comes about. So number one would be the obvious point that countries are walling themselves off when it comes to their internets, right? So like China took itself to its logical conclusion. Post-Ukraine war, Russia is doing the same thing, obviously not as effectively on a couple of different levels, but it's still just a reality. You know, access to the global commons from the internet's perspective, which seem to be a vulnerability if you're an authoritarian state. You have the issue that given the tariff policy, countries are reshoring. There's a big Bloomberg piece about this a few days ago that people should look up within this. On and on and on and on, like multilateral institutions basically have very little credibility, even from folks who used to be much more liberally minded towards them. I don't see anyone waking up and saying, you know what, the WHO is going to be the centerpiece of everything we do moving forward. So speak to that aspect, because I was just trying to emphasize that that is not a technological question. There's actually much more of an ideological, diplomatic, and sociopolitical one.
Totally. Well, again, it's kind of what is your time frame? Like what lens are you looking at? And, you know, I wouldn't, you know, yes, there's the ebbs and flows, the 2 steps forward, 1 step back. We're actually in a backlash phase right now on a lot of things, because there was a lot of huge strides in the last 25 years that elicited a backlash. And you're watching people trying to recalibrate. Okay, well, maybe this wasn't a good idea. And how are we going to do that? But I'm saying the general motion of what human beings are going to do in this across this century, and certainly in the next 30 years, is inexorably over time going to be more global. Even if you were kind of fundamentally organized at kind of, you know, city, state levels, or, you know, regional levels, or there'll be all kinds of ways to organize your locality, or where you put your primary energy, or where you stay, or how much global travel will be. I mean, there's going to be a lot of things, and, you know, you can't predict with certainty. But I will say this. And if we're going to have 10 billion people on this planet, we're going to have to increasingly, not decreasingly, coordinate. Now, whether it's going to be in the next 5 years, there'll be some backlash to it or whatever else. Over time, that is how it's going to have to happen. And so the sustainability, I'm just arguing. And I actually think you could look back on the history of human beings and watch this inexorable kind of progress. Again, with backlashes, okay, we had a World War II that bifurcated the world. Oh, but then we kept going after that. I mean, it's kind of lunges forward and backward. That's one thing. The other thing I would just point out to you, which is you're looking through the lens or the kind of metrics or the analysis of essentially the last system. You know, oh, the WTO, no one wants the WTO. Yeah, WTO, you know, was essentially an explosion of new institutions after World War II, when they did actually have to rough out in real time, okay, what is a more globally kind of integrated world, internationally integrated? It wasn't really globally in that way in terms of the seamlessness. But he was like, how are we going to build an international system? Oh, let's create the United Nations. Oh, let's create, you know, World Bank, or let's create the IMF, or, you know, eventually the WTO. Those are creatures of a 20th century kind of bureaucratic kind of, you know, post-war world, which is, you know, they did a damn good run at it and they did a pretty good job, but that's not what's going to navigate us through the 21st century. And so I think the bigger way to think about what's going on now is we are between, and I think it's a lens for almost everything around us today, the way I think about it, we are between two fundamentally different historical eras. And if you really go further, and I do this with certain audiences when I talk, I do a lot of public speaking, I do a lot of advising, frankly, senior advising with people running companies and stuff. The biggest lens, the biggest picture of what's going on is we are essentially between two fundamentally different historical eras that really, if you push it, which gets trippy, is really a different kind of civilization that's going to emerge over the course of this 21st century. And we are still in the kind of grips of, if you really go back, a civilization that was built in the Enlightenment, that came out of the Industrial Revolution, that kind of got peaked in the kind of 20th century. And that kind of was that world of how it all worked. And hey, we have carbon energy and we got these mechanical things. And we basically, you know, have these nation states and we have liberal democracies and we have financial capitalism and, you know, it goes to the shareholders. And anyhow, that system, which was basically created in the Enlightenment, rolled through the Industrial Revolution, peaked in the 20th century, is kind of over. Weirdly, I mean, it's not immediately over, but I think what's really the more fruitful way to think about it, at least for intellectuals and people like me who can kind of have the freedom to do this without, you know, having to make it in the law tomorrow, is that we're actually, that system is winding out. It's coming to the end of its kind of usefulness. I mean, the carbon energy is now screwing up the whole climate. Financial capitalism and made these insane kind of inequities that are just not sustainable long-term. Or, you know, you can take any one of those great innovations of the Enlightenment and of the 20th century that have just kind of, you know, the bureaucratic kind of, you know, administrative state and welfare state just clunking and wheezing and, you know, have all these things in their time were new and breakthrough and amazing. And they've actually all brought some humans and brought Americans or whatever level you're talking about to better places over time. And some, not always, but usually we've been moving forward on this. Those things are hitting the end of their utility. And so the next systems are essentially being born today. In fact, if I did the shorthand of what I think the next 30 years is the next 30 years is we have to lay the groundwork for that next fundamentally new systems. And I think we're well on it. And I think it's happening around us. And I think that's the future. And I think that is goes a long way to explaining when people say, oh, yeah, that won't happen. That's exactly what happened in the 90s. Oh, no, one of these Amazon, what's an Amazon? It'll never be a big company. Oh, it'll never be valuable. Or, oh, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's like, it's because they couldn't see the system. But once the system got going, now, you know, these are trillion-dollar companies running the entire world. And everyone's freaked out about them now. But it's like, yeah, because this is only 25 years in, right? And so I think we're at a similar place with energy, with biotech, with those things, but also I think in so many other things, including our social and political institutions. And so I would say never when it comes to global. I mean, if you just think through logically, what are human beings going to have to do by the end of the century? We're going to have 10 billion of us living sustainably on a planet, or we're not going to move any further than that. And I think if that's the case, there's a logic in there that people are going to acknowledge, deal with, evolve, modify. And that's where we're at. We're at a big juncture in history, not just a little election cycle or that. We're at a time of fundamental transformation. And that's, I think, the easiest way to understand what's going on. It also explains American politics, explains a bunch of things. If we want to go into that, I can explain it, because that it's a very, it makes really clarity of like, ah, that's why this shit's happening now.
Yeah. And I want to hit your scenarios, but I just want to give one more point of reflection on what you're saying. It's given what you just pointed out around me basically using 20th century like frameworks and even language to like kind of critique your point. It's sort of like me looking at the invention of the nation state after the Treaty of Westphalia in the 1600s and saying, but what will the Pope say? You know, it's sort of, it's bringing, it's sort of like, okay, that's, you know, okay, Otto von Bismarck, that's interesting, but I'm not sure the Pope's going to be down for merging Germany into one. So I was just like, so I think that's a good way. That's a good way of illustrating your point, which is that if you're going to be skeptical of these things, like ask yourself, am I describing something empirical, or am I using language and concepts which aren't truly structural and just are kind of, I don't want to say like organic, but kind of are just organic. So yeah,
emergent. The other way to think about it is there's an emergent world here. And I spend my life, basically what I do for a living is look at that emergent world and try to explain it to people early and give them sense of what's coming and help them actually with strategy and thinking about that, whether it's privately or publicly or whatever. That's what I do. And in that emergent world, it is getting clear enough to me and to others like me that we've tipped. It's moving. Mm-hmm. There's this new thing happening. And that is the way to analyze the current, let alone the past, And in fact, the work right now is rolling up our sleeves and figuring out how does the system work. And you know, like you said, it's like, how would a new, I'm not saying it's going to be one global government. This is the other thing. People think, oh, you know, we're never going to listen to like some cabal at the top of some global thing. No, absolutely not. There'll be some, but there will be some kinds of much more sophisticated global governance or different ways that, you know, interconnections or kind of ways of coordinating things globally, mm-hmm. that will be very different. They'll be networked. They'll be based on the 21st century technologies. It will be for, you know, have to do with digital. It'll be, you know, could be blockchain for that matter. Good, but it could be AI enhancing it, whatever. There'll be a bunch of stuff that we're trying to figure out. And we can't tell from here how it's exactly going to work. But I can tell you for one thing, there will be a system that will supersede this totally balkanized, only national boundaries, you know, or even in the case of the U.S., you know, these kind of little state lines and stuff. I mean, we're just all so freaked out. And in America, it's just insane. We're hanging on to a system that was built, designed in the 1780s. They didn't know what electricity was, you know, Ben Franklin with his key, let alone electronics. I mean, it's like it was a totally, the idea that they had some insight that should rule us for the next 250 years is insane. I mean, it's just an insane political ideology that actually talks clear and curiously about that. I mean, and so we'll look, you know, and here we are. So we're watching the end of all these systems that, you know, were functional and brilliant at the time and useful for a long time that are just increasingly just not mapping onto the world, which is, by the way, is going into hyperdrive with climate change and all kinds of stuff going on here that we got to get serious about.
I want to push you on one thing, though, especially the reference to what insight did the founding generation have. I would say the insight would be people who live in, you know, Texas, where I just moved, are different at some level than people who live in Maine. B, it would be separation of power. Like, this I can articulate.
Yeah. So I'm not saying it's useless. Yeah. You know, let me be clear.
Sorry,
I'm not saying it's useless. In fact, it was brilliant at the time. In fact, I'm reading right now, Isaacson's, Ben Franklin biography. Mm-hmm. On the 4th of July, I said, oh, heck, I've been meaning to read this thing. Anyhow, and you get your head back in that scene and you go, these folks, the founders were brilliant. And how they made the lunge forward from their world was just magnificent. And, you know, for as much as the hand wringing about what they got wrong back then, the things they got right were amazing. We should bring many of those into the 21st century, no question about it. But the idea that there's some originalist text, like kind of the old, you know, some kind of like the word of God thing that, you know, we just can't violate or we can't modify is to my mind is the wrong way to think about that thing. This is getting way off, but I think through this century, there's going to be some fundamental changes to democracies, how they function. I think they'll be infused with technology, by the way. And I think there'll be ways that, but let's not go there right now, but I'm just saying the idea that we're going to be in the end of the century, going to be still be going through this knucklehead system that we basically are, you know, it's just tying us in knots now is remote. Let's just put from my point of view in terms of Sedaris.
And I think the way to think about it from a, you know, once again, like positive, like optimistic framework is that what makes countries like the US and like even France successful is that they can reimagine themselves every period. You know, you have got got the five republics, you have Abraham Lincoln, you have the New Deal. It seems like one of these projects politically this century is what is that next, like, so we have, you know, we had the Great Society, like what is that next iteration of like the nation within that. So I think that's the way to frame it. And I need to get to this so that, because we keep previewing it. Can you just give us a couple of the worst, the scenarios you laid out in the essay that kind of came to pass? Because we kind of, that's a little off script, but I want to just drop that in before I forget.
You're talking about the long boom?
I said we were going to bring it up. We didn't bring it up. I just want to drop it because someone's wondering where they are.
There's many ways to go. I mean, it's not so much the specific little, you know, oh, this exactly happened in this year, but it was a story. You had to tell that story. So there were some things, you know, many things on, many things off. But I think I would call it the through line, the basic through line that was accurate. Let me give you one that we haven't touched on right now.
Yeah.
In 1995, when we were doing this, the GDP of China was essentially $1 trillion, which, you know, for a country of over a billion people was like, nothing, a little knucklehead place. It's, I mean, that's a little bit harsh, but I'm just saying it didn't matter in the world economy kind of thing. And we were predicting with globalization the rise of China. Now, we weren't the only people doing this, but I was just tying one of these threads out, right? We said, look, China is now entered the global economy, which, by the way, it just happened. I mean, you know, they kind of had some in the 80s, but it really was starting to catch on in the 90s. We said, we'll play this thing out. These guys are going to be rise to become a global superpower. By the way, by 2020, because I've kind of done the numbers on all this, you know, they were about at $16 trillion. They were the second largest economy in the world. And of course, all the things we know was amazing about that. We also said what they're going to basically do is transform that country in the space of 25 years. And they did. They pulled 800 million peasants living on less than $2 a day, which is the kind of extreme poverty of the world, which is still used as a metric. They took 800 million of them from the countryside, barely hanging on at $2 a day. And they brought them into these cities. They got them actively involved in functioning in working in an industrial economy. They basically had a rising middle class. They did all this stuff in the space of 25 years. It's a world historical thing. It's just amazing. They cracked a model, frankly, that the rest of Asia and other places have been trying to emulate and could in the future here too. That's a crazy big thing. We just lay that in as kind of like, oh, this is one more thing that's going to happen, right? And again, at the time, people think, well, no, they're communists. Oh, no, they'll never figure that out. Or, you know, oh, anyhow, there's a million things that people were saying at the time. But if you just played out, oh, with this new global economy and those supply chains and all the labor cheap and, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyhow, you can play that out. By the way, that scenario that played out for 25 years is now going under a huge difference in China because, whatever, they don't have the people. There's a bunch of ways to talk about how now that we knew how China worked for the last 25 years, extrapolating out and thinking, oh, this is the future for China is the wrong call because, in fact, they're doing a bunch of dumb things and they've got demographic challenges with no young people and all kinds of stuff happening that is not going to be the China of the last 25 years. So that's a different topic. But point is, from that period, you can make a pretty damn good call that would happen. And again, so we did them around the economy. We did them around the rise of these. I mean, again, Apple, I'll give you one other example. Apple Computer, we didn't use this specifically, but the month, that article came out literally 25 years ago today, this month. I mean, it was July of 97. Now, it had been kind of written in the 96 and we'd kind of been playing with it in 95. So I was kind of playing with it. I've been using mid 95 for you, like 95 numbers. But anyhow, Apple that month was begging Steve Jobs to come back to become CEO because they were 3 months away from going bankrupt. I mean, Apple Computer was essentially on the ropes. It was going to go under. There's a whole story of how that got saved. But the point is, they later, now, as we know, became the first $1 trillion company. There's never been a fucking company that hit $1 trillion. They did that about 3 or 4 years ago. And now they just, beginning of this year, they hit $3 trillion. I mean, there's like, and all the, it's not just them, it's all the tech companies hit the top, the commanding heights of the global economy are all $1 trillion companies. They're all sitting in California and Seattle. And it's like, who knew at the time, you know, this could happen? We said, yeah, this is what's going to happen to these companies. Now, do we say exactly the company and whatever? I'll give you one other little thing, which we got caught up in. People thought the long boom and they thought, oh, you're talking about the stock market. We were talking about fundamental technology boom. We're talking about a fundamental economic boom globally. But we did kind of allude that a shitload of money to be made. And so we got categorized in the .com thing as, oh, these guys are just talking about, it's about stop, you know, boom. And there was a book at the time called Dow 36,000.
Kevin Hassett, I was hoping you were going to make the reference.
Yeah, no, totally. Because our book, when our book came out, we were in that same period. And they say, oh, the long boom and Hassett's book. And it's like, these guys are insane, you know? And so, and of course, with the .com crash, everyone said, see, they're idiots. They don't know what they're talking about. Well, just to say, our scenario was going to 2020. And what happened at 2020? The Dow, which, by the way, in 1995 was 5,000, made it to 30,000 by the end of that 2020. And it was an incredible stock boom. And so, again, these are things that were, there's a lot of side things on that. But let's just say, those through lines for human beings and wealth creation, all kind of stuff, really positive, I would argue. And, those were good. Now, there's things we got wrong. Like we thought hydrogen fuel cells, for example, were going to be kind of succeed essentially the carbon energy or the internal combustion engine. And that didn't play out the same way, although there's a little role for it still. But anyhow, stuff you could kind of miss some of it. But in general, I would argue and defend that. Now, again, a lot of things went wrong, and I don't know if we want to go there because we got so many other things to talk about going forward. Yeah. But we did also say, hey, stuff's going to happen in the next 10 years or the 25 years. that's going to be bad shit. It's going to happen and it might slow it down, but it's not going to, the key is it's not going to stop these trends. And in fact, they didn't stop these trends.
Yeah. Once again, going back to those three, digital infrastructure, energy, and then the global context, that's the big story of the century. Those individual events won't slow that down. Let's focus.
Can I just add one thing when you say about the sustainable, the clean, sustainable, there is a kind of a pure renewable energy, that kind of thing. But there's also a whole, what I would call with biotech, I don't know if we want to go there, but essentially one of the big developments that's really going to lay out, essentially create the sustainable society is essentially biotech, genetic engineering, synthetic biology, a lot of things that are not strictly speaking pure energy plays. And then there's other stuff that even goes beyond the renewable energy, like fusion energy and others that I expect probably not, might get commercialized in the next 30 years, but over the century, I think it's going to happen. Anyhow, there are things that are, you know, beyond just what people think, oh, solar energy, wind energy, that kind of stuff. But that said is, yeah, I just wanted to broaden the sense of how mm-hmm. big and complex that sustainability thing is. It goes into materials, it goes into all kinds of stuff we're going to do. And food, meat, all kinds of stuff that's going to happen with that essentially is a whole nother booming area that's going to take over the next 30 years. Anyhow, we don't have to necessarily go there. I just want to say it's big.
Yeah, no. I like the way you signposted that well. So I think folks who want to focus on the area should go there and follow up, because we have to get to the California as the metaphor for the American political system right now. So like you wrote a series focused on this idea that California is 15 years ahead of whatever is happening nationally in American politics. You make the point of Goldwater, you make the point of Ronald Reagan. So could you basically introduce, this piece came out in 2017. Listeners who were paying attention to our biology episode will remember biology mentioning that Jack Dorsey particularly enjoyed this series that you put together. So can you just introduce the idea? It's been a couple of years, but can you just give like the broad framework for the idea there?
Sure. And it's still playing out. So it's relevant literally from last week, which was the last week of the Supreme Court. And we can kind of get to that connected to the cutting, you know, breaking news right now. Okay. So the biggest thing that I would, my view, taking that big view, and I'll get to this answer, but it kind of mm-hmm. puts it in the context of what we just were talking about. The biggest view, the way to, for me to explain what I would say is going on in American politics, given this backdrop of this other world historical things happening, the backdrop for me in American politics is essentially American politics, to my mind, and I can make a strong case to this, and others have done this, is essentially a pendulum swing between essentially conservative eras and what I would call progressive eras. People call, you know, the last version of progressive is liberal, but just think of it as there's a progressive tradition and there's a conservative tradition. It plays out in Europe, it plays out all over the world, frankly, playing out in China, frankly. But in American politics, we've seen this many times. We saw the post-war was a progressive era and the build out of the, you know, great society and the welfare state and American version. And then it was succeeded with, you know, Ronald Reagan, and the whole kind of Republican revolution of the last 40 years has kind of been a conservative era. Even Dems in that kind of play within the context of the general tax cutting and, you know, unleash the, you know, power of the private sector and, you know, focus on freedom rather than equality. I mean, there's a bunch of, you know, just ways those eras kind of work. And both of them, by the way, are vital to kind of revitalizing American society. I'm not one of these people that's totally one side or the other. I actually see the value of both. My mind, Trump is the last of that, is defining, and the current crew hanging on to that Trumpism is essentially, to me, the marker of the end of that conservative era that started with Reagan and Thatcher, for that matter. And it's also happening in Europe, by the way. There is essentially a sea change that's happening, not obviously immediately and not exactly to script. And there'll be 2 steps forward, 1 step back. But the best way to understand it is that era is over. It's kind of this ideas are brain dead. It's like not working. It's in climate denial. There's a bunch of stuff going on there. It's just not mapping out a 21st century. And essentially, there is still an emergent kind of politics of what is that politics that's going to supersede it? What is this era's version of American progressivism? And again, when I say progressive, it's not like the bleeding edge lefty that's like out there screaming, but it's essentially the ballast of essentially what I would say, since we're talking about California, California Democrats are one way to metric of this. Yeah, the long short of it is I see that era happening. And that's the way I see what's going on in the bigger picture. So I could see as soon as Trump got in there, I was like, folks, don't think that this is the beginning of a new Trumpist MAGA world and the resurgence of the Republican Party. Just see it as kind of the death throes or just kind of the craziness that's going to come as they try to hang on to power and try to do anything else they can do. Meanwhile, people are like, well, what the hell is going to supersede it? I said, what's the closest thing we have in America is blue America is going to win this struggle between the two Americas. And I'm still with this, by the way. Blue America is going to win over time for all kinds of reasons. They're at least dealing with the 21st century problems. They've got the demographics behind them. They're actually anyhow, a lot of reasons for it. They have all the cities. They have all the tech industry. They have the knowledge workers. They have all kind of the coalition they have is just much more powerful than what the red has. And over time, that's just going to win. And I said, the closest thing you got to seeing what that future is in California, where right now, but even in 2017, you had, you know, everybody at the top, every statewide office was Democrat. The supermajorities in both House and Congress. And people say, well, yeah, but, you know, that California's always kind of weird and it's always been this kind of its own thing. And, you know, yeah, they're always been liberal and all this kind of stuff. That's totally not true. I mean, this is California has a long history of essentially previgoring the American future in all kinds of things, cultural trends, societal, you know, social trends, technologies, you know, you name it. I mean, California is just all in it. When I say always, not way back when they were just this dinky little thing on the Pacific, but I'm saying for the 20th century, they have prefigured so much of what America is. And I would say, and frankly, they were blazed the trail for the Reagan Revolution, the conservative whole thing, the tax revolt. Yeah. I mean, all kinds of stuff. I mean, you can just lay out all that stuff and say they were a total red state. I mean, you know, basically California had voted for Republican presidencies all the way till Clinton in 92. I mean, they were just, well, with the exception of Goldwater, they couldn't go with Goldwater, but basically there was a red state. Then what happened in the 90s is it became a polarized 50-50 state where nothing got done. It was a total warfare. Everyone said California was a basket case. And it was only about 2005, and there's a whole way you can get into the weeds on what the pieces were here. But in general, what happened in California was the Republican Party got so crazy, so kind of in denial about climate and things that were issues, so backlash against diversity, which was apparent all through the society. So they were kind of doing, in essence, what a lot of the national crew is doing now. But they weren't working with people. They wouldn't compromise with the Dems. Anyhow, eventually California just said, there's 40 million of us, by the way. It's like I said, this isn't working. So we're just kind of create a super majority of 60% of the population. We're just going to work within the Democratic Party. At least they're playing, you know, trying to deal with reality here. And there was a lot of reforms in California, too, by the way, top two voting, a citizen district forming, you know, legislative districts. So that wasn't kind of gerrymandered. There was a lot of kind of progressive the referendums here, which people complain about all the time, but people could actually like get it ahead of the politicians in Sacramento. And, you know, California evolved. And so this thing now they've turned into this very blue state, a very, very progressive thing. But it wasn't baked in and it wasn't just California. It was, I would say, again, just like Reagan and the tax revolt in the late 70s and all this kind of stuff was essentially about 15 years ahead of where the rest of the country, where it finally went the rest of the country. By the way, Reagan was, in the mid 60s was governor and eventually, you know, he was president in 1980. I mean, there's a bunch of metrics you're going to explain about this. By the way, Schwarzenegger, our guy who's kind of this, you know, movie star, famous guy, didn't know anything about politics with our Trump, you know, 15 years ahead of Trump. You know, there's a bunch of parallels. And all I'm just saying here is, so if you really want to take a look at the closest thing right now, that where the future might be in a blue America, this is that. And I would strongly argue that this is what's happening across America. I mean, you're down in Austin. I mean, basically, because the coastal, the cost of, you know, urban living and stuff, there's been this dispersion, particularly with the pandemic, of the coastal millennials.
I came from New York, so
move it to the heartland. They're going to Austin, they're going to Miami. I mean, those states are going to, they're going through the same changes, the immigration thing, the people of color, the young people, the, you know, the tech people, the intellectual kind of from, you know, knowledge workers. I mean, it's just going to change the fabric of them things, just like they did in California. And they're not going to be, hey, I want to pack my gun and, you know, ban abortion and, you know, deny climate. They're just not going to resonate with that. And so over time, those states are going through this change. By the way, it's happening in every damn state like this. If you look at Nashville, you name it, all a lot of these places are just getting the reconfiguration of the country now around housing and all kinds of stuff is happening this. So here's the thing, you know, right now, it's impossible for a Republican to win a statewide office in California. Right now, Beto is making a very credible challenge to Abbott. He's within about 3 or 4 points right now. Georgia did flip, basically blue in the last election, and that two senators. I mean, this is, and by the way, the whole Southwest, which had also been kind of Republican red states, are now all turning blue, both in the presidentials and also all their senators are now blue. This is an inexorable, one-way inexorable push that's going on. Kind of, let's think of it as a Californianization of what's happening in the world. Now, if you say this on Fox News or something, they'll go nuts. They'll go ballistic. And everyone will say, well, they got these homeless people. Who wants to do that? No one will ever do that. Bullshit. This is what happens in these big stroke historical junctures of American politics or of the world context I was talking about. Things that you thought would never happen. Oh, we'll never elect someone from California as president, you know. Watch. I think the most interesting guy right now is Gavin Newsom for president. I think it's really interesting to see whether that guy is actually going to, I think there's a good shot he's going to be president at some point. It's not even, but I think it's increasingly interesting whether it'll be 2024. But I'm just saying things that people say never, oh, will never happen. That's the old lens looking at the old thing. And also when the country's in crisis, when things are moving fast, when big shit's happening fast, a lot of things can happen fast. And I think the U.S. is at that point now. I think, just keep it going one notch, I think the United States right now is in a period where we were in the 1850s before the Civil War. I think it's close, and also the 1930s. I think both of these periods essentially were closer to quasi-Civil War, not, well, the one in the 50s, 1850s, literally ended up in Civil War. But even in the 1930s, I mean, the fundamental differences between the parties, and it got so extreme, it's so difficult that at those junctures, everything gets polarized and gets extremely volatile until there's a break and a reconfiguration of essentially a 60% majority of the country. This is why when I saw you, when you approached me first and said, oh, the realignment, I think what America is going through right now is essentially a reconfiguration into a 60% majority that is essentially going to get behind a transformative set of policies that is going to take on climate change, is going to engage in the complexity of diversity in this country, is going to actually deal with the extreme wealth and inequalities of, you know, late stage shareholder capitalism, are going to really start to deal with these in the way that previous eras of American history have fundamentally reconfigured at these junctures off these things. When you're in the pre-era, 1850s, 1930s, it looks horrible. It looks like a disaster. Everyone hates everybody. Nothing gets done. It gets super extreme. You know, fascism comes up, all kinds of stuff in the 30s. And Civil War, we know all the stuff that was going on there. It eventually breaks, and they're one side or the other wins. It's not like, oh, well, I'll sit back down and bipartisan this out. No, we're not there. And I laid that idea out in 2017 once Trump won. Going into the 2018 midterms, I said, look, we're going to watch the beginning of this shift. And lo and behold, 2018, huge backlash against Trump and the Republicans. The Dems kind of taking the houses. 2020, we know Biden wins. Electoral College, not even close really at that level. And now you can say, oh, Biden's in trouble and that and all. We can get into the details there, but in general, the structural thing right now that's happening is the country is going through a century reconfiguration. Now, I'll go one last piece about this. The people in power get this, which is why you're watching, particularly on the other side. I don't know where your politics are, or the people in your audience are, but I would say one of the reasons you're seeing extreme, the extremism, like let's do a coup or a quasi coup or whatever you want to say, or let's don't hand over the election. You know, that shit happens not from a party that says, oh, we'll win next year. We'll win the hearts and minds of the country, or, oh gosh, you know, yeah, this is, it's just a, we'll go next time. No, they realize it's the end of the road on some level, certainly for Trump. And that's, you know, if you really believe in your, you've got the hearts and minds of the Americans and the future of the country is behind you, you're not restricting voting, you're opening voting. You want more people voting because they all love you. Anyhow, a lot of this stuff's happening, and I'll even go further. That this whole thing about the Supreme Court that just came out with all the kind of, it's interesting. Well, the New York Times, right after the last of this climate change things that came out last week for your readers, I don't know, your viewers, if you're going to, when you're watching this, but essentially the closing of the Supreme Court, when they laid out all those things from Roe to all the way to clipping the wings of the EPA, the New York Times front page of the physical paper, which I still get as an old newspaper guy, it said, this was the most conservative court since 1931. Interesting. What happened in 1932? Well, you had a huge election win for FDR, and you had the beginning of essentially the New Deal coalition, and you saw the talk of packing the court, which they later scaled back and things like that. And you saw coming off the war, the beginning of a very different society, a very different kind of, you know, you'd say a progressive era in that terms, that built out the post-war world and built up the infrastructure, the international systems we know today, and all the positive things that people love about America and we think of as the heyday. So I'm just saying, I think we're in one of those junctures now. And I think the Supreme Court playing its cards right now, weirdly in their own heads, know that they've got a window here and they're going to play their cards now rather than waiting 5 years, 10 years, whatever. It's like the country's shifting and you're watching, to me, one side is realizing the game's over. They're on the wrong side of history on this. Are playing some very dramatic cards, which are getting very scary to a lot of people who believe in democracy and all this stuff. And the other side just doesn't have all the answers. And it's, you know, got old guys like, you know, Biden, who's in the old, he's from the old system, or even Pelosi and all these people. It's like, they don't have necessarily the big broad stroke visions of what the next thing is. But that's where I say someone like Gavin, which I think he's really an important player right now, in California in particular, is going to start articulating very quickly the alternative, because this stark contrast between red and blue America is coming to a head, and Americans have to do something about it. And without being too political at this stage, is if you can't talk politics now, you're not talking about what's going on in the future here. And I would just say this decade is going to be a critical one for this country, but I think it's going to, in my mind, break blue, break towards the future, and we're going to begin a crazy transformation in all kinds of ways. Anyhow, that's my long-winded way of explaining to you, but frankly, I really feel strongly about this. And I actually think I laid this out in 2017, as you mentioned, and it got a lot of play, but also got a lot of huge pushback. It was playing in right-wing media and stuff like that. And they were just screaming at me. I had literally death threats. I literally would get, because at that time I had my own startup, and I had an office in the Mission in San Francisco. I had literally people saying, we know where you live, we're staking you out, you know, we're taking you out, all kinds of stuff, because it was touching a nerve. And it was saying, you know, I was laying out what I think is really happening, but some people didn't like that. So, I wouldn't change. I mean, maybe I'd change a few words of what I laid out there, but I think in general that story still sticks. And I hope if people are interested, go read it.
Yeah, no. And I want to calibrate this response very precisely, because we genuinely have a balanced audience here, but I definitely know that to your point, the right wing part of the audience is not going to be happy with a lot of what you said. Look, you are very explicit with what you feel on this. You've written like 4 essays on the topic. So I suggest folks who disagree with what you said, like, read the essays more in depth. I don't want to quibble too much. That's a little boring with a specific like politics scenario planning bit here. A couple points of clarification though. So one, I'm curious what you think the role of, like, you know, I don't want to say like great man theory of history, because obviously like that's somewhat like not taken seriously as a model anymore. But like, what do you think the role of the individual politician in these transformative moments is? So for example, you could say something like, you know, in 1931, you know, you have the most conservative Supreme Court, but then FDR comes in. How much of that New Deal narrative is America was transforming from the, you know, end of the Gilded Age to like the more progressive 1940s and 50s. How much of that is like the structure and how much of that is FDR? We could look at the 60s and talk about how, you know, you had the Great Society. If JFK isn't assassinated, then it's most likely that, you know, LBJ isn't even on the ticket in 1964. And you don't have that similar level of like progressive change when it came to legislation. So what is the role of the individual and the talent of an individual in the story you're telling here?
Super good question. And by the way, I think leadership counts immensely. And let me just correct the record here. I'm not just some, you know, card carrying Democrat or kind of some lefty intellectual that just, you know, was my side or everything. I appreciate basically the broadest, both sides of the American kind of, you could say, political kind of realm. And I would argue what I call the A-team. I think what's happening right now, and in fact, there's a lot of people I follow closest in terms of intellectuals, in terms of political analysis, stuff like that, are actually conservatives, or you would probably libertarian or right wing, and kind of however you might think about it. I was at Wired Magazine when it was kind of considered a kind of right wing crazy thing. And when my long boom was considered, you know, kind of a neoliberal screed. In fact, just literally this month, the New Statesman, a kind of lefty publication in England, just kind of tore me up about how what a disaster the long boom has been for 25 years. Anyway, I kind of get hit from both sides, depending what's going on. And I think, but that said, it's because I think there is what I call there's an A-team of both sides that are actually divorced from the kind of petty politics of kind of, you know, that electoral politics and all kind of stuff. They're trying to figure out how do humans essentially deal with these crazy big challenges of the 21st century or any era, but right now. And so to me, there's essentially when I say this reconfiguration politically, there is a literal political coalition, but I would also say it's a reconfiguration of innovators at the broadest sense, or intellectuals, innovators, entrepreneurs, all kinds of different things that are trying to break out of the old brittle boxes of both parties or of both, you know, ideologies, however you want to think about it, to get at what to do. I'm extremely pro-tech in a way that the kind of, you know, left now is kind of going apoplectic about and stuff, because I just think it's fundamental to human progress. We're just going to have to do this. And frankly, it's largely been more positive and ahead of us. If we're going to solve these things, we need tech. So anyhow, which tends to resonate more with the right and conservative politics. Anyhow, so it's just kind of mishmash of what's happening. But what I would say is there is this kind of distillation of essentially people that are breaking free of this. One of the people, just by the way, who is one of the great mentors of mine is Stuart Brand, who I don't know if you've ever had Stuart on this thing. Stuart, I worked with him at Global Business Network, which was his pioneering strategic foresight group. I spent 4 years with him, closely working with him. I'm now entangled with the Long Now, which is his, which he founded, which is a fantastic group of future thinkers. I've been doing a lot of work with those folks. Stuart's a great one like that, you know, who helped start the environmental movement. Then he said, you know what, we're going to need nuclear power. So like, this is crazy. And then, you know, he was kind of all the people going organic farming. He's like, no, we need genetic engineering. You know, it's just because he's thinking big, he's thinking centuries. He's thinking through the century, you know, through the 21st century. I'm totally in that ball. And so I think there's a reconfiguration of essentially what needs to happen in America and around the world right now. And I think there's this, I just vaguely call it the A-team on this thing. So anyhow, the point when I'm getting to that was just to put, you know, it's not like my side or your side. I think there's this thing about what's emerging. That said, is I do think politics is extremely resonates with you need good leadership. And I do think entire scenarios, largely positive scenarios driven by big trends can be screwed up by the lack of leadership or essentially a leader moving in the wrong direction. I would say this one thing about, you mentioned how much was accurate of my 25 years from the mid 90s to 2020. The area that was the most problematic was politics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we didn't see, you know, the 911 backlash in the Middle East kind of, you know, coming out of nowhere. And we didn't see, you know, we were thinking, you know, kind of Al Gore in the 2000 election. You know, it would have been natural for us to see coming off Clinton, you know, Gore going on. And, you know, he was all about climate change. And we thought, okay, that's going to take the climate world to the next level. And of course, Bush wins and it goes a different way. And anyhow, so life, and particularly through politics, can really make huge impacts on what happens. And so, yeah, I'm hugely big on that, which is why I think it's important to talk openly and freely about what's really going on here, because we need people, we need the right leaders to step up, but we also need people to understand and recognize good leadership. And we can make the wrong, we can absolutely make wrong choices here. And the wrong choices we make in the next decade, by the way, are going to, could be really disastrous, particularly around climate and others. But I would say this is a time for real leadership. Now, to me, it's kind of next generation leadership is where we got to be looking. I think we need young youth vitality, and kind of rather than kind of the last, you know, Washington today is just like filled with these kind of, you know, eight people in their 80s and stuff. It's like, no, that's, those people are not going to help rough the future. I mean, nothing against them, whatever. And there's a role to play in there. But I'm looking to, I think right now we need some real leadership. And so I think we're going to get it. I think America, the thing about America, which is, you know, for all it's wringing your hands, in the end, the country somehow figures it out. And, you know, we eventually get into World War II, or we eventually kind of, you know, solve stuff. And it, you know, there's a serendipity of it looking back. But I think it's more like a homespun kind of decency and kind of common sense of Americans in the end, at least 60% of them. And so I actually believe right now we're going to see a reconfiguration of those kind of Americans to kind of pull the country in a direction. I think it's going in this direction. You can disagree about me, but I do think it's very different what's going to play out than what most mainstream media or conventional political analysts, pundits are saying right now. They're fighting the last war. They're making the last analysis. They're not seeing really with full understanding what the hell's going on right now.
Two quick things before we close on your transformation project / idea. Everything you just said. So I want to do a quick note. I would push back a little on this idea that it has to be the next generation.
Yeah, that's true.
In the sense that, A, who would have thought that the person who would pass civil rights, Medicare, Medicaid, Great Society would be an old racist Southerner
that's true.
Who didn't fit the narrative, because like, and it wasn't, you know, JFK knew from I'm very pro JFK. It wasn't JFK, because at the end of the day, LBJ had a specific skill set that met the moment better than JFK's skill set when it came to passing legislation through the Senate. So I'm just suggesting to people that we be cautious. I broadly agree if you're on the next generation point. I'm just saying I too often get audience feedback that basically says, man, all these old people, I just want young people in. And I say, guys, Madison Cawthorn was a terrible congressman and he was young. There's that Lauren Boebert's 36 years old. There are plenty of very, very young people who are quite destructive in the political system. So I just want to make that point. But then too, though, this is why I'm skeptical. Of your articulation that California is the future, because I don't think the structural dynamics of California are designed to produce the set of leaders you're really talking about. So for example, why is Kamala Harris, I think frankly, like underperforming relative to Biden, underperforming in the Democratic primary. She was never truly road tested. She had one competitive election in 2010. And that's probably the best year California Republicans are going to have for the next long while. She had one single competitive election. So she was never road tested in a competitive or even moderately purple state. So like a state like Virginia, which is like lean blue, put aside Youngkin for a second, that still has the underlying dynamics. And then two, because it's a one-party state, I'm from Portland, Oregon. So I very viscerally feel that in a one party state, there is no next generation. You have Barbara Feinstein and then, you know, boxer Gavin Newsom. I mean, I first heard Gavin Newsom when I was in seventh grade, when he was mayor of San Francisco, letting gay marriage come through. That's because he's been on this. It took him so long to even get to this point as governor. That's the underlying dynamic. I mean, the governor before him, you know, this was Jerry Brown, who in his third term was first elected during the 1970s. So could you just like reflect on that dynamic, which is that like at a vision level, I love your idea that this is a moment where there's going to have to be a choice, right? So I'm interested in like Ronald Reagan's Time for Choosing speech in 1964. That's basically what I think the 2024 election should come down to. Like there's the progressive vision. There's the conservative vision. Yep. Put aside inflation. I know you're pissed about energy. Do you really want the Supreme Court to go with whichever side? That's the Trump argument. That should be what the Biden argument is, or anything like that. So I agree with that part, but I don't see a politician who's able to do that coming from a one party state, you have to wait in line for 40 years. So I'm curious what your reflection on that would be.
Well, just to be fair, it's not just California that's one party state. I mean, basically many of the red states, Texas and others, technically up to now, and now they're getting challenged and pushed, you know, to
And no president's coming from Texas. That's my point though. Like it's kind of interesting. Like I think Ron DeSantis is served well by Florida being a weird,
purple state. I like your proving ground there. And I would say the existing, both parties, frankly, have this to a certain extent, although weirdly the Republicans are a little better with letting in the next blood of younger people. Although, you know, it's, you know, look who's running the Senate, you know, and the whole thing. Yeah. I mean, so it's kind of a plague on both parties. It's kind of an ossified party, two-party structure that is really long in the tooth, way too long in the tooth. And I don't even disagree with you. Like the idea that Feinstein is a senator is insane. Not just her dementia thing, but just the idea that she even ran last time and a bunch of stuff. It's just, it's the baked in ease essentially of someone of seniority to keep in their job. And the idea that they think they're essential to it, like, you know, even RBJ, you know, the kind of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I mean, the idea that they just think they're super essential at the very end, and it's like not true at all. It's just ridiculous. Anyhow, the point is, I'm with you on that. I'm on that same side. I will say this about Gavin Newsom, though, and I have known Gavin. I have interviewed him publicly and privately. I've done a couple, you know, very big onstage kind of interviews with him. I've gotten to know him off that, too. And I know tons of people that work with him. That dude is smart. He is really something different. He's not kind of just an autopilot kind of guy. And I think if you really looked around America for someone who would be up to the challenge of this 21st century challenges of America and the world, you'd be hard pressed to find someone like him. I mean, just from an intellectual point of view, I mean, he did come of age running San Francisco at a time when essentially the, you know, global tech tycoons were kind of reconfiguring around there. He knows all of those folks and he totally gets it. I mean, he can talk to you about the dangers of AI and the kind of, you know, all kind, I mean, anything around those topics, you know, he can run circles around most people and he totally gets it. But he also, he did his time as lieutenant governor for two terms, you know, going to every corner of the state. And he really has done. He learned at the master. As much as you think about Jerry Brown, the guy was a wise old man in politics. And there was a lot he learned from him. And, you know, California, again, is the fifth largest economy in the world. It is a nation state. It's 40 million people. It punches way above its weight, both in the United States and also globally. We're totally pushing the envelope on climate change. The interconnection to Asia is just way more than any part of the country, period. I mean, San Francisco, which he ran, is a third Chinese. I mean, just start with that. Silicon Valley is huge chunks of Asians. I mean, LA is this global melting pot that just puts to shame fucking New York and the old El Salvador thing. I mean, this is a country that is embraced, and we got wildfires all over. And, you know, this is game on out here. It's like the 21st century is happening now. Whites are 32% of the population now. It's like people are wringing their hands about whites as a minority. It's like, yeah, that's California. It's been going on over. I mean, we've set so many trends. I mean, you know, I remember when we banned, you know, smoking in restaurants and bars, everyone said we're insane. And now it's the global standard. I mean, you can just go you mentioned the gay marriage, all kinds of stuff. I mean, this is a different animal. And I would say, yeah, there's problems with California, but I would really push anyone out there and people on the other side too, to say, who would you really want in terms of tested by the 21st century, ready to really stand up, understanding social media? That's why what he's doing to DeSantis in Florida is great. He's taking it to these folks and he's not backing down from Trump and all these people. But a lot of the other old school Dems, they don't get that world. They didn't come up in that. You know, that was just second nature for Gavin. So I don't want to overdo Gavin. I'm not saying he's the only answer, but I would say, again, at a juncture like this, look between the smoke of the, you know, the daily kind of news and the tweet storms and all kind of shit, what's happening in the bigger picture. I would say keep an eye on that dude. And also think about America as not just like, oh, it's another cycle or, oh yeah, the traditional midterm thing. America is in fundamental crisis right now. I don't want to be the guy shrilly, you know, but it's like, you know, read the Atlantic or do whatever you want to do on this stuff. This is not your normal time. We are in a really different time. And when you get into those really different times, people can listen. They let go of old ideas relatively quickly when shit starts moving and breaking. We're in a shit moving and breaking right now, period. And so I would say any of these things that, oh, they'll never elect a guy from California. oh, you know, any, all those kind of maxims or, you know, I think are over, honestly. And I think we'd be really well placed to kind of try to be get free of the past thoughts of what makes shit happen. And really break out of that, because we're in that time. And I think we'll look back on this. It'll look obvious in 10, 20, 30 years. You're kind of, oh, yeah, of course it happened. This is what we do now in the digital revolution. You know, we just started this whole show. So you look back at the way that, oh, of course the companies are going to be like this. Oh, of course everyone's going to have iPhones. Oh, of course Moore's Law is going to continue. Oh, of course China was going to rise. Oh, of course, you know, there's going to be a backlash to globalization. Oh, of course. Anyhow, of course, of course, of course. Right. But at the time, nobody fucking said that. Nobody said that. We're rare, or a few people. I'm saying a few other people. But I'm just saying, we're in one of those times now. Don't get fooled by the past, frankly. Try to think in the future. That's the key. And that's what I'm doing. That's what I do. That's what I'm going to spend the next 10 years doing, is trying to breathe life into that next thing and advise people and speak publicly and do things like this with you and get people energized around essentially the transformation this country and the world's got to go through. And it's game on.
Yeah. So just
game on.
Two quick questions to wrap. One would be, given your framework, then is your put aside like outcome, is the best scenario for the country then DeSantis versus Newsom in 2024? Given what you are articulating needs to happen in terms of like younger, two very Florida versus California. Would that be your best case scenario from a resolving one side winning perspective?
Well, now you're going to smoke me out a little bit. I mean, I would want in that lineup, I would want Gavin and California and the blue states to win over that, over the vision that DeSantis is doing. So it's going to be hard for me to say. And I think if Trump runs, it's going to be a disaster for the Republicans. I think even if he runs in the primaries, he's probably going to do it just to kind of keep out of jail for now. So that's just going to be a horrible thing. I mean, basically, by the way, everybody who says this is going to be a red wave election is insane. That's not happening. In fact, I'm telling you, this is a different election with the Supreme Court just out of there. I mean, with Trump thing, January 6th stuff going, with Trump jumping in the race ahead of the 2022. I mean, honestly, damn, I'd almost rather have our hand dealt to us right now. The blue state hand rather than the red state right now. But I would say, you know, just from a kind of a clarity of intellectual discussion, I mean, I think that would be a good one. I think, you know, because Trump is a buffoon, in my opinion. I mean, he's ignorant buffoon in my way. I mean, that's probably going to send some people off. But I mean, I'm just saying, but DeSantis is not. That dude he's smart. He's sharp. He's kind of built on a different set of principles. And I think that would be a reasonable way to kind of, if the country was going to honestly look at the distinctions between different ways forward, that would be a reasonable one. I would rather tip the table a hand to the blue side, but that's a reasonable thing we say. Let me just say one last thing about this. And yeah, this has changed my thinking. I'll tell you about scenario thinking just one last bit. I am increasingly entertained. I used to just think, okay, America is going to evolve this way, and then blue America is going to win, and it's going to play out this way, and it's going to be another swing of the pendulum, and we're going to build this next thing. I mean, that is playing on essentially a historical understanding of how this shit works. It's possible that it might actually not work that way for a bunch of reasons, some of which I mentioned, which it might be a totally different game right now. And I've been actually thinking about this. It's possible that the best way forward for America would be to devolve into increasingly autonomous regions or you know, everyone talks about secession and all these kind of things. It's too dramatic to think about right now. But what's one thing that the Supreme Court has kind of thrown out there that's made me think differently is there might be, which I hadn't really thought about much, I was always resistant to, but there could be a scenario here that could be the best of, you know, what we can come up with, is some way that you would devolve into essentially regions that are just very distinct in many respects, but kind of live and let live, loosely coupled, and have some kind of federalism that would reasonably work. Now, there's a lot of issues with that, and if we had more time, we could go into why that's not a bad idea. But I'm just saying, I'm starting to entertain that idea. And what it links up to is essentially some discussions I'm having, particularly through the Long Now Foundation, which thinks very long term. They're building a 10,000-year clock, among other things we can go into. But I've been running a series of conversations called the Civilization Salons, which are a private conversation by a dozen people we take a topic, we push it out 25 years, and we say, like, democracy in 25 years, or collective intelligence in 25 years, or commerce in 25 years. And we have a group of really unbelievably amazing folks talking about what the questions they'd have about that, what they think would happen in those 25 years. And I will say there is, and these are kind of that A team, the global elite kind of people. I won't name drop just because I can't really do that. Right now. I shouldn't do that. But there is a general sense in the world right now, in this A team, that the world itself is going through something that is closer to the changes that we saw like in the Enlightenment or something, that are so foundational and so almost civilizational scale changes. And things that even like economic theories, I've had a Nobel laureate, for example, in one of these conversations who is rethinking his whole thinking around economics and how it works and what we need to do going forward that he would never have done. I mean, Nobel laureates rarely go back on what they said. And again, this was private, so conversations, who knows? But anyhow, it's indicative of, I could tell you tons of these people, that there is a real sense of being distraught of like, oh my God, what is happening in the world right now? And how are we going to rethink and fundamentally redo and transform essentially the world around us in the coming 25 years, really? And so, or, you know, whatever it's going to take, 20, you can talk about it. But anyhow, let's just say 25 years, because it was good. That's a metric we were using all this time. I'm in that camp. I think, and so one of the things that's happening out there is thinking, will we reorganize the planet in more kind of city states? As cities seem the most coherent and workable unit of democracy or government or whatever. And is there a way that you could see a more fundamental restructuring of the planet around kind of city states that would be connected, you know, loosely in these old, you know, nation states that still have something to do. But essentially the action wouldn't be there, and it would be these city states connected globally through some kind of infrastructure. It has to do with production. You know, what could we do kind of, you know, 3D printing and all kinds of stuff? Will we need to redo the entire global supply chain in ways that maybe we need to, and climate change? Can we even travel the way we used to travel? I mean, it gets into that level of kind of rethinking the fundamentals of what the 21st century is. And if you kind of let go like that, then you could say, well, maybe, you know, trying to cram all those 50 states and get them all aligned and, you know, beat the shit out of the red states if you're the blue states, and, you know, then have that rear guard action constantly at nipping at your heels. Maybe it's better just to kind of let these regions kind of work themselves out and connect up to the greater global whole. That's a trippier thing, and that's kind of earlier in the thinking, but it is something I've been thinking increasingly about, and I'm not the only one thinking about that. A lot of people are starting to think about that. And if you think that way, then you think, well, maybe this will tip in some crazy new direction at this juncture. So it's a possibility. It's a scenario I'm entertaining increasingly by the day, because I don't see these two sides getting along very well for a long time to come. And even if you tip a 60-40 reconfiguration majority, which I've been talking about, and I think is the probability, that 40 is just going to be, you know, could be just steaming in ways that could be, you know, really destructive. And so maybe we just need to kind of let the 60-40 kind of reconfigure and let the 40 do what they're doing and let the 60. Now, it's not easy because the country isn't that regionalized. I mean, you know, blue cities in red states and red parts of California. So it's not the cleanest thing. But that's what I'm saying. These junctures, stay open to really, really different kinds of outcomes.
That's a great place to leave things. Peter, could you quickly just shout out in like 30 seconds or less, because we're nearing time, just the transformation, like your latest series, like throw people to your writing. We couldn't hit everything, but you've got a really great archive that folks could look at.
Okay, well, the transformation is essentially my attempt is a sequel to The Long Boom. The Long Boom, which we talked about a lot about, ended in 2020. I picked up at 2020, went to 2050. It's 30 years, but think of it the next 25. And I was basically trying to think, using the same methodology we used back then, to kind of create a positive scenario that could play out, that would have that same kind of energy and that same kind of knitting together and connecting the dots that we did back then. I think it's a six-part series in Medium, which is more, as opposed to Wired Magazine, which, by the way, I used to run in the 90s. That was the managing editor there, just shortly after I wrote that piece. But this time I thought, you know, it's online. Let's get it so people can comment and get it. And it's living there now. And you didn't just miss that month's, you know, thing. And yeah, that you can see that body of work there. But I will say one thing about it's a lot of the ideas I laid out here put this together. I will say it's a fictionalized scenario. It's told by someone in the future in 2100, basically a Gen Zer who is going to live till 2100. By the way, every Gen Zer is going to probably live 100 years for all the things we know or close to it. That's barring disaster again. And this character is looking back on the critical years from 2020 to 2050 and how we laid the foundations for this much more all digital, fully sustainable, and ultimately global kind of world, and did solve the big challenges of the time, including climate change, which is the mother of them all, but also some of these other things that are dogging us, including political polarization. It lays it out without a Pollyannish way, but just kind of based on the trends I've been talking to you here, lays out, okay, how could that play out? To give people a similar idea of filling it out, giving them a texture, giving them a sense of like, oh, that's how it could go. And also being able to react to it and say, that's insane, it'll never happen, whatever, have their own thinking about it. But right now we need people to understand, how can we solve climate change? How can we build a different kind of capitalism that essentially people call it stakeholder or whatever they're starting to talk, but how do you spread wealth differently and make sure it gets all around the society in America and around the world? And then third one is, how do we actually deal with this kind of global system that we're going to need at a planetary scale? It talks about the bare bones of how we do that, could do that, and makes people think. And then it ends, I will say this last thing, is it actually opens the lens to the entire century of 2100. And by 2100, this character is looking back and realizing that we not only have laid the foundation for those big three things, but we essentially have created a different kind of civilization that is comparable to what happened in the Enlightenment, which if we had more time, we could lay that one out. But basically, these are meta innovations that will last, could last for centuries. And I think we're in this game. And I would just say for your readers there, listeners, is I always remind people when I do my talks, and I've been doing a lot of these talks around this stuff, is honestly, people are going to remember this era for literally centuries. And just remember how, what an honor, or what an amazing opportunity, or however you want to think about your own role in this, is it is an amazing time to be alive. And people will literally remember this for, I mean, this era right now is kind of going to go down as the among the big ones out there. And, you know, we could totally blow it and it could be a complete disaster, which is what 90% of the people think, or we could pull this thing off, which is what I think. And I'm betting we're going to do it. And the story is going to live on. So anyhow, that would be the way I'd close it. And hopefully we'd talk another time.
Yeah, Peter, thank you so much for joining us on The Realignment. Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the show of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for a lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.